From KLW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Pusher City.
Redwood City.
Wilmont.
Midtown. San Jose.
19th Avenue. San Francisco.
San Mateo.
Sunnyvale.
Excelsior District of San Francisco.
Financial District.
Coming up, we'll dig into the fight over one of California's natural resources, gold.
I think you have to fight fire with fire. I don't think that, trying to talk nice or to negotiate something, I don't think that gets you anywhere, not when you're dealing with people who don't acknowledge your right to exist.
Contemporary gold miners and the environmentalists who hate them. Also, a new study about empathy burnout.
It's not that some people have more education or more physical strength or more mental strength. It's your perception, the way you deal with this stress.
We'll help you deal with your stress on Cross Currents. Ever since the Great Recession hit in late 2008, many Americans have seen their investment opportunities dwindle. The stock market's constant fluctuations scare off the more conservative among us, and interest rates for savings accounts or CDs are so low they don't even seem worth it. Meanwhile, costs of living continue to rise, and if your income isn't going up, which is the case for almost everyone right now, then this all makes for a pretty uncertain financial future. Many institutions are trying to capitalize off this uncertainty by urging people more aggressively than ever, it seems, to invest in a resource they claim never loses value, gold.
You don't have to watch your hard-earned savings shrink to nothing. Invest in gold. During tough economic times, gold is the time-tested currency that goes up, not down.
In case you hadn't noticed, the U.S. economy is in the midst of financial crisis. There is one asset that provides both insurance and security. That asset is gold.
And with gold continuing to sell at historically high prices, it's no wonder that the hunt for the shiny metal is alive and well. But in 2009, California made things a little harder for the would-be gold miner. The state outlawed suction dredge mining. It's a technique that makes finding gold a lot easier than just shaking a pan, at a potential cost, however, to a river's ecosystem. Officials wanted to study possible damage to the Klamath River, an area where there has been a lot of dredging. Reporter Hadley Robinson has the story about the struggle for power along the river.
On the swift-flowing Klamath River, at the base of steep, forested mountains, sits Happy Camp, California, a town of just over 1,000 people. Yes, it's called Happy Camp. It's a quirky place, part of the Jefferson County that once tried to secede from California. Nearly a quarter of residents are members of the Karuk tribe. And the town prides itself on having more Bigfoot sightings than anywhere else. It's also a place where you can find something else.
And big nuggets.
We got nuggets.
Don't some enthusiasm.
We got another band?
Yabba dabba doo.
When you find a piece of gold, you're the first person in history to see that. God put it there how many thousands of years ago? You're the first person to see it.
Myrna Karn spends her weekdays working at the local gold mining equipment store. Is run by a club called the New 49ers, a reference to the old 49ers who first found California gold. Over the years, the club has acquired hundreds of federal mining claims along 60 miles of the Klamath River. There are 1,200 members, but anyone can pay a fee to try to find their very own sparkles of gold in the water.
It's just the thrill. It's just like back in the old days, you know, West days, you know.
People interested in gold have been here since Happy Camp was the Old West. They started coming in 1851, when gold was first discovered in the area. When the gold rush ended, Happy Camp became a logging town. The last mill closed in 1994, and since then, the town's businesses have survived the summer months thanks to tourists, who, like their predecessors, come for the gold. Myrna Karn says it's not really a way to make a living.
It's more a hobby. To make a living, you'd probably have to work 10 to 12 hours, and I mean hard hours, not going out in the water for an hour and taking a four-hour break.
Still, in a depressed economy, even a little money helps.
I have seen a man just working up on shore, panning, and he come in with about $40 worth of gold for the day. So he's able to go buy some groceries.
Starting in the early 2000s, gold prices soared, and more people made their way to Happy Camp. The founder of the New 49ers called it a new gold rush. People joined the club, set up RVs, campers, and porta-potties along the river, and spent weeks searching for gold. Most of the miners used a machine known as a suction dredge. It's about the size of a small raft with a motor that sits on two pontoons. Miners swim alongside wearing scuba gear, diving to the bottom to dig holes for a large hose. The hose acts as a vacuum and sucks up sediment into a box on top of the dredge. Then the miners sift through it, looking for gold. Here's what it sounds like.
Are you seeing any gold down there?
Yeah!
But there was basically a wholesale invasion of the Salmon River. And all of a sudden, instantly, it was overrun by suction dredge mines.
Leif Hillman is a Karuk and one of the leading opponents of suction dredging.
It looked very ugly. And quickly, there were conflicts with our tribal membership, for sure.
Swimming holes that people were used to splashing in were suddenly filled with dredges. Formerly pristine shores were covered with trash. Hillman says the tension led to physical fights. But a bigger issue was fish. Even though the river doesn't have enough fish to feed the tribe, fish still play an important spiritual role in Karuk culture.
We are a fishing people. Everything, you know, we live along the river. And the river has sustained us for, you know, forever.
In 2005, the tribe sued California Fish and Game for allowing suction dredge mining in areas where there were endangered fish populations. A court ordered the agency to do a comprehensive review and update regulations. And in 2009, the state temporarily banned suction dredges. Last summer, the ban was extended until 2016, pending more environmental review.
When you talk about, well, maybe it's just a small impact, but when you have an invasion of a place like the Salmon River that houses remnant populations that don't exist anywhere else on the Pacific coast, that's a pretty important place. And the last thing we ought to be doing is allowing mechanized, motorized, you know, intensive mining activities in that habitat.
Back when the first gold miners came to Happy Camp in 1851, they blew out mountainsides for hydraulic mining and used literally tons of mercury to process the gold. Hillman lives and works at the tribal office 45 miles down the river from Happy Camp in a small town called Orleans. We stop along the winding road that looks down a steep drop to the roaring river. A black bear pounces around the shrubs on the other side.
Yeah, it's a beautiful country, and people stop and they look at places like this. And what those people don't see is the historic legacy of gold mining here on the Klamath.
There are a lot of environmental arguments against suction dredge mining. Gas pours out of the motors and into the water, and the vacuum hoses likely suck up crucial nutrients and insects in addition to dirt and gold. But since it's been banned for the last three summers, it's hard to see any remnants or damage. It's actually easier to see the impacts from the original gold rush, areas where hydraulic mining took out mountainsides and tailings piles were thrown on riversides.
We destroy nothing.
Jim Foley is a member of the New 49ers. He says suction dredge miners don't do the river any harm.
We move gravel around. That's all. We take it from here and we put it right over here. And I'm talking about a distance of maybe 4 feet.
The arguments are endless, but this battle seems to be about more than the environmental impacts.
The agenda of those that are against mining is not about mining. It's not even about fish. The real agenda behind the scenes is about control of natural resources.
These tensions run deep. Foley goes on to say it's unfair the tribe gets fishing privileges. He accuses them of wanting white people off the river. Hillman won't say that, but he makes it clear that he's bitter towards miners.
You know, the new 49ers are a lot like the old 49ers. The first gold rush that occurred here, you know, we lost 3/4 of our population was murdered. They were displaced from their homes, from their lands.
Hillman is quick to point out that those conflicts weren't that long ago. Those people were his direct relatives.
I can take you to places and point out places where there were armed conflicts, where people are buried. You know, I know their names. You know, I know what happened in that place. So it feels very close to us. And the trauma on the culture and the people, our way of life, our religion, everything else, we still struggle with those effects today. They haven't went away in 150 years.
So for now, the suction dredgers are gone. Anyone who wants to look for gold has to do it the old-fashioned way. People living in Happy Camp notice the difference, but they aren't all happy about it. The miners may have brought RVs, temporary camps, and trash, but they also bought gas and groceries and a solid bacon and egg meal before hitting the river. Debbie Virtue is a waitress at Frontier Cafe, and she wishes she was serving up more of those breakfasts.
Oh, I've been here 24 years, and the last three summers have been the slowest, this one being the slowest of those three.
When I talked with her around 9 a.m., my friend and I were the only two people in the restaurant. When we came back for dinner at 6:45, it was already closed. In this battle, there's no tie. There's the view of Jim Foley.
The only way that I see it getting resolved is through a lawsuit. And unfortunately, this is the way that all of these things get resolved in the end. Nobody can seem to come to a middle ground on anything outside of a lawsuit.
And the view of Leif Hillman.
I think you have to fight fire with fire. I don't think that that you know, trying to talk nice or to negotiate something, I don't think that that gets you anywhere, not when you're dealing with people who don't acknowledge your right to exist.
Even after 160 years, the power struggle along the river goes on. For Cross Currents, I'm Hadley Robinson.
Hadley Robinson is a reporter at the UC Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism. And you can hear all of our stories at klw.org. That's also where you can subscribe to our podcast. This is Cross Currents from KLW News. I'm Holly Kernan. As we just reported, a growing number of people are trying to track down the precious metal gold. There's even a TV show called Gold Fever. And the fight over mining for gold up in California's gold country could be a symptom of a much larger problem, unemployment. It's still high in the U.S. About 8.5% of Americans are unemployed, which is why the prospect of mining for gold to earn a living might not seem like such a bad idea. But even those of us who still have jobs in this depressed economy face a host of problems. What happens if you don't like your job? What if you're interested in a career change? Chances are you're not going to just quit because it doesn't interest you anymore. The idea of going out into an incredibly weak job market is enough to make the most courageous person think twice before leaving his job.
I sit in a cubicle and I update bank software for the 2000 switch, and it doesn't really matter. I don't like my job, and I don't think I'm gonna go anymore.
So you're gonna quit?
Nuh-uh, not really. I'm just gonna stop going.
Many of us have experienced burnout when we get bored with our work or sick of our colleagues, for example. But what happens when your work is all about other people? If you're a doctor or a nurse or a teacher? Researcher Eve Ekman says you're more likely to experience empathy burnout if you're in one of these caring professions. I sat down with PhD student Eve Ekman to find out about her research on empathy burnout. I asked her to start by telling us what she sees happening.
Luckily, this picture is not totally grim. As a social worker in the ER the last 6 years, there's a high volume of suffering. The intensity is quite high, and you know, people are coming in every day with things such as traumatic accidents or chronic illnesses. And when I watch staff interact with these clients, I started to take note that many people, despite this high volume, were able to still be human and present and engaged.
And compassionate.
And most people would believe that being exposed to that level of trauma on an everyday basis would kind of shut you down. And often actually what's taught in medical school is to kind of shut down, to withhold emotions in order to be able to perform your job. However, emotions are such a critical part of our job, in especially quick momentary assessments, as we need to do in the ER, as well as these big transitions when you have a sudden mortality or a sudden loss of medical ability due to an accident in the ER. So my interest was, how do I understand, you know, the portion of the staff that are able to empathically engage, seemingly endlessly, to those who seem to have absolutely no empathy available whatsoever?
Just because they're too overwhelmed and stressed out by the caseload?
This is what I was wondering. I was lucky enough to start at the same time as about a dozen nurses who are all around my age, so in their early 30s now. And when we started, we were all about 25 or so. And they were coming from varied backgrounds, but had gone through the same nursing program. time. They were all hired at the same time during this kind of up hire at that time. So it was a little bit of a perfect sample, a naturalistic sample, we call in the sciences. And I saw that some of them, every single day, despite the kind of patients spinning and yelling and, you know, some of our more difficult patients, were still able to be totally human, maintain their integrity, and treat these people with respect, whereas others seem to have no patience whatsoever.
So what do you think was the key difference?
So I think, you know, of course, there's some differences in the way that people are brought up and they're raised and their education, their training. But essentially what it comes down to is a model of stress. There's some stress that makes us feel threatened and some stress that makes us feel challenged. So our response to stress that is threatening is we kind of, you know, pull everything in, shut down, and don't really engage. When we are challenged, we raise up to that. Our entire autonomic nervous system, our heart rate, everything is engaged so that we can meet this challenge. So what I really thought of is some of these nurses feel incredibly challenged and some of them feel incredibly threatened. And luckily, there's a great deal of research from this field of stress that helps us understand where this comes from. It's actually your perception of what's going on at that moment. If you feel you have the resources available to meet the demands, you know, it's not that some people have more education or more physical strength or more mental strength. There's a lot of equivalency across these. So it's your perception, the way you deal with this stress.
So give us one example, a concrete example of somebody dealing with this and maybe not feeling empathy.
So I think, you know, in the ER, what you often see is, you know, you have these chronic patients who come in who seem hopeless. So they are inebriates, you know, you have this,
So you're drunks who are coming in
every day,
every month.
And they are, you know, they're barely making it to the parking lot before they fall down and they come back in. You feel like you're not getting any work done. They're often rude, they're mean, they don't smell good.
They're taking up space where a little kid who has pneumonia might not get into the ER.
Exactly. And they're often berating to the staff. So you get this very difficult situation, and you have staff who are quickly dismissive of these patients. What we can actually know from research is these patients are really sick. And so by kind of ignoring that this person, despite their kind of difficultness, actually has medical issues, you are increasing the likelihood they'll come right back. They'll get more sick. They have, you know, chronic heart disease. They have pulmonary issues. They have diabetes. And to kind of bring them in and just do a tertiary exam and let them go because of your inability to really see their suffering.
That's researcher Eve Ekman. She's with UC Berkeley. And we're talking about this idea of clinical empathy and caregiver burnout. And you give another example of a young man who came in with a bullet wound.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so, you know, we have such a high volume of gang violence in the ER, and it's very deeply upsetting for people who work there. You see young men dying all the time, and the families who are affected, it's such a small community, unfortunately, that when these situations occur, the entire community shows up. Our staff has a negative reaction because this means there's a lot of emotional people in the ER and they have a young man who might be dying. So the first reaction is let's shut it down, let's keep it safe. And that often means that let's keep family members away from their dying loved ones. So how do you convince staff that it's really important that the family needs to be there in case this is the last time they see their son? Yes, they may be crying. Yes, they may be falling on the floor, but it's our responsibility to recognize that this mother is losing her son.
We've been mostly talking about healthcare.
Mm-hmm.
What about things like the education system?
Mm-hmm.
Teachers are so overstressed and,
sure,
and very underpaid in,
yeah,
a lot of cases. What's the relevance here for teachers and people working in juvenile halls,
right,
et cetera?
Absolutely. Well, my field research is in juvenile hall, and it's a little bit of a stretch for some people to consider guards in a juvenile hall to be care providers. I couldn't disagree more. I think they have a lot of the same desires that school teachers have to make a difference in the lives of youth. And my preliminary research there and the focus groups I've been doing, I've been proved right. All of them got into this work because they wanted to make a difference. And the great deal of stress and frustration is when they don't feel they can. And it would seem common sense, but, you know, I was very shocked to hear that there's no trainings that exist currently for staff burnout in the criminal justice system, the juvenile justice system. And, you know, with school teachers, I think you have much of the same concern where majority of what brings people to the work is their desire to do well, their desire to make a difference and do good. Often that is, unfortunately, becomes an albatross around your neck, becomes a thing that can pull you down. And burnout research has actually identified a separate scale for school teachers that really emphasizes how important it is to get that feedback.
From students, from colleagues, from whom?
That's a great point. It's from students and from colleagues. Sometimes we need that support from our coworkers. People are often surprised when I tell them that my study on empathy isn't just about the care provider to their client. It's about the care provider with their coworker and with their client. Empathy is requires that people are aware of what's happening with them in terms of how they relate to others. Others is not distinguished between simply their clients. And that's why this research is relevant, actually, to lawyers, of course, to folks in the corporate world, and kind of across the board. My intent is to start with those I feel are in the deepest need, but I definitely see how these ideas could be used in many settings.
That's UC Berkeley researcher Eve Ekman, and we're talking about clinical empathy for caregivers and particularly burnout in the workplace for people who are on the front lines, particularly nurses, teachers, etc. And you have something of a prescription. Your research has led you to believe that there are things that you can do to increase empathy, or clinical empathy, as you call it.
The reality is burnout, it's not an endpoint, and it's not just some people. There are, I think, cycles of burnout. People will feel burnout, and then they won't, and then they will again. So how do you address burnout as a long-term job issue? I think there's a couple simple steps, which is really orienting yourself to your own physiology. So that means feeling your toes, feeling your knees, feeling your hips, feeling your elbows, feeling your shoulders. By the time you get to your head, you're calmer.
Okay, so number one, check in with yourself physically.
And another, I would say, is definitely to, by whatever means necessary, increase support you can get from your coworkers. So if that means that everyone brings lunch for someone once a week, or everyone has this time in which they check in, you don't want to create more time in the workday. You know, folks are eager to leave. You don't say, yeah, let's all stay after for an hour. No, that's not realistic. However, creating these very small ways in which folks in some ways support and or celebrate one another, this is hugely important. And the third, of course, and this is by many folks the most important, I think just one addition, is what it is that you do outside of your job that gives you meaning, that gives you a break. And to make sure that you spend as much time investing in that as you do in the workplace. So I'm not saying hour to hour, but if you are going to work every day, you need to create a container for what you bring home. Now, one of the things I'm working on is a tool that will help folks check in through text message. Create a
report. Or just a little chime.
A little chime, yeah. And I think, you know, you can also do data collection through this so that what you create in the end is a little report. So after the end of a week, someone sees, this is what I did, this is when I was stressed, this is how I felt. Interesting. So you, again, give people more opportunity to know what it is they're doing and feeling and not become robotic in their everyday work life.
Eve Ekman is a fellow at UC Berkeley's Greater Good Science Center. She's also a PhD student at Berkeley's School of Social Welfare. To hear that interview or anything else from our show, go to klw.org. And let us know if you're experiencing workplace burnout or how to deal with it. You can give us a call at 415-264-7106. Just leave us a message at 415-264-7106. You've been listening to Cross Currents from KLW News. The team includes Hana Baba, Julie Kane, Martina Castro, Jen Chien, Audrey Dilling, Julia Lundberg, Casey Miner, Nina Marente, Erica Moo, Rena Palta, Brian Pelletier, Seth Samuel, Stephen Short, and Judy Silber. Today's show was engineered by Chris Hoff. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. Also, thanks to City Car Share, which provides an alternative transportation option to our reporters. City Car Share is on the web at citycarshare.org. And thanks to you. We are listener-supported radio.
Tune in to Cross Currents tomorrow at 5. We'll be meeting your neighbors in Berkeley.
Actually, Berkeley is probably the best place to be homeless. There's a lot of services for people that are homeless, such as free meals, shelters, people walking around with blankets, and just all kinds of things.
That's tomorrow at 5 on Cross Currents. It's important to stand out in the music world. That's why the Heavy Thin, what you're hearing right now, is described as the Bay Area's only almost all photojournalist rock band. Most members work as photographers for their day jobs. They're on the program Friday the 13th at the Stork Club in Oakland, along with 5 other bands. To hear them and all of the local bands featured on our show, visit us at our website. It's klw.org. For Cross Currents, I'm Holly Kernan.